From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as Syrian refugees flood into Turkey fleeing Islamic State extremists, we ask if former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair is right to say a Western troop role against ISIS should be on the table.
You can't interdict and defeat an organisation like IS with air power alone. There are times and points at which you actually have to have somebody on the ground.
Also today, we look at what lessons the US can teach the UK following that historic vote in Scotland. And we talk to our Africa correspondent about unconfirmed reports of the death of the most wanted man in Nigeria.
Troops of Cameroon on Sunday night claimed responsibility for killing Shekau, with photos of the Boko Haram's leaders or his corpse as one of the proofs.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts with the latest world news. The United Nations has called for urgent help for Turkey, which is dealing with a refugee crisis along its border with Syria. The UN's Human Rights Agency says that some 130,000 Syrian refugees have crossed the border in recent days. Syrian Kurds are fleeing in their tens of thousands from Islamic State militants who've grabbed control of large parts of Iraq and Syria in recent months. Turkey has now closed the majority of its border with Syria. Laura Wells is a freelance journalist in Istanbul.
Turkey keeps on opening and closing the border. They say it's because of security reasons. But of course, this is a very large number of refugees to come in at one time in a very remote area of Turkey, and they certainly want to prevent a humanitarian crisis.
Western militaries are reportedly engaged in an urgent effort to train Kurdish fighters to combat Islamic State militants. As Malcolm Brown reports, the U.S. and allied nations are trying to address shortcomings in forces which are central to the anti-ISIS strategy.
American, British and French advisers are reportedly on the ground in northern Iraq, working to boost the capabilities of Kurdish forces. The Wall Street Journal reports that the training includes the use of sophisticated weapons, such as advanced anti-tank missiles. The paper says the Western trainers are also working to transform the Peshmerga from a predominantly guerrilla fighting force to a more organized force, capable of urban combat and holding ground. Malcolm Brown, Washington.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is continuing to defend a peace plan agreed Saturday despite more reported deaths of government troops. The ceasefire talks in the Belarusian capital Minsk resulted in both sides consenting to create a buffer zone between the opposing forces, but Kiev says it won't be implemented until the violations stop. Jack Parrick reports from Moscow.
A Ukrainian government military official says they've had two men killed since Saturday and estimated the pro-Russian rebels had lost 40. An original ceasefire agreement from September the 5th was largely violated by fighting on both sides. The new one is to prevent military aircraft flying over the battle sites and for both sides to withdraw weapons over 100mm calibre back 15 kilometres. Separatists are currently in control of the disputed city of Donetsk, while government forces are held up at the city's airport. Russia continues to deny any involvement in the conflict, which has killed over 3,000 people.
The US Secret Service is launching a full review of Friday night's security breach at the White House. That's according to presidential spokesperson Josh Earnest. He said President Obama was obviously concerned that an Iraq war veteran had simply jumped over the fence, run across the White House lawn and entered the building before he was caught. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. One day after a large-scale climate change march through Manhattan, hundreds of environmental activists are on the move again. They're headed for New York's financial district to demonstrate their belief that America's economic system encourages investments that harm the environment. New York correspondent Patrice Howard reports.
The protesters aren't occupying Wall Street. They say they're flooding it. More than 1,000 activists showed up to blockade Manhattan's financial center, dressed in blue to represent a human wave that could potentially slam into the low-lying city like Superstorm Sandy. Their message is that big companies are not chipping in to aid the global warming fight. But across town, Progress, the Rockefeller family whose fortune came from big oil, announced that they will divest some of their fortune from 200 major oil and gas companies for the environment's sake. This just one day before world leaders gather for the UN climate summit. Patrice Howard, New York.
The US Space Agency's Maven spacecraft has successfully entered orbit around Mars, completing a journey that's lasted nearly a year and covered over 440 million miles. The robotic explorer will now study the red planet's atmosphere, paving the way for the human explorers that NASA hopes to send to Mars in the 2030s. Lorna Shaddick reports.
Maven's been travelling through space for the last 10 months after being launched from Cape Canaveral last November, but it's now fired its brakes and slipped into an elliptical 35-hour orbit around Mars. Flight controllers will now spend the next 6 weeks adjusting Maven's altitude and checking its 8 science instruments before starting to investigate the red planet's upper atmosphere. All the work will be done from orbit. Maven isn't designed to land. Scientists believe the Martian atmosphere may hold clues as to how the red planet went from being warm and wet billions of years ago to cold and dry now. It's thought that early moist world could have held microbial life. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Turkey has closed the majority of its border with Syria after an estimated 130,000 Kurdish refugees poured into the country over the weekend. The Syrian civilians were fleeing the violent advance of the Islamic State militants, who continue their campaign of persecution across both Iraq and Syria. IS, meanwhile, has released a recording taunting President Obama and urging supporters of the terrorist group to launch attacks against civilians in America, Australia and France. Laura Wells is a freelance journalist in Istanbul.
Since Friday, the Syrian Kurdish refugees have been pouring into Turkey. They're now surrounded on all sides by the Islamic State. Since the past week, there are fierce clashes around the town of Kobane in that area. And this area had been about 300 kilometers, or about one-third of the border between Turkey and Syria. It's a very dire situation. Many of these refugees were on the border for 3 days before Turkey started allowing them to come in on Friday. We've seen clashes also at the Turkish border. Some of the locals who are Kurdish have been clashing with police. They want to allow all of the Syrian refugees to come in all at once because Turkey keeps on opening and closing the border. They say it's because of security reasons. But, of course, this is a very large number of refugees to come in at one time in a very remote area of Turkey, and they certainly want to prevent a humanitarian crisis.
And Turkey has taken on a vast number of people, refugees, fleeing from the brutality of the Islamic State fighters. But surely it must be reaching breaking point. 130,000 people over just one weekend takes it up to a great number that Turkey are now responsible for.
The refugees who have come in most recently, they can't even be fully accommodated by the Turkish government, who has already accepted over 1.2 million Syrian refugees in the past 2 years. They're staying with other locals. Some of them are staying in temporary tents. So it's a very difficult situation at this point.
And do we know the situation that these refugees were actually fleeing in Kobane in Syria? Do we know anything about that, ISIS spread in that particular part of the country?
Yes, Islamic State has surrounded the Syrian Kurdish area. The only way to go in or go out is through the Syrian-Turkish border. So they are literally trapped. Right now, we know that those YPG militant forces, which is the local semi-autonomous Kurdish area in Syria's militants, they are fighting with Islamic State and fiercely. But from what we understand, they are greatly outmanned and outpowered in terms of weaponry. They simply do not have it, and they don't really have access to it any longer. They cannot get anything from northern Iraq, the Kurdistan region, even if they wanted to. We're hearing that Peshmerga cannot get in. The only way they can come in is if they go through Turkey, and Turkey is trying to stop any fighters from entering this Syrian Kurdish area through their border posts.
So greatly outnumbered, greatly outgunned. Is there a feeling in Turkey that perhaps it's time now for the United States to shift its military focus to Syria as part of this wider strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy the Islamic State militant movement?
Certainly, Turkish Kurds and the Kurdish community at large in the world are asking for airstrikes on the Islamic State so that we do not see a massacre, whether it be of the Kurdish militants nor the locals who have stayed. But at this time, we do not know if that's going to happen. That's a stickier proposition, which would include Assad at this point. I don't think you're going to see any activity from the Turkish government unless Islamic State starts coming into and attacking the Turkish border. Because remember, the Turkish government has been having a problem with Kurdish separatist militants like the PKK for over 30 years. Tens of thousands of people have died in this conflict. And within the past year, the Turkish government has spearheaded a peace process in which it has asked PKK to disarm, which seems impossible at this point, considering the entire international coalition against Islamic State is arming all of the Kurdish militant groups in the entire area.
And how alarming is the Turkish leadership finding this, these growing calls for Turkey's Kurds, young Turkish Kurds, to take up arms and head into Syria to assist with that fight against IS?
Well, some of the skirmishes and the clashes with police and other military officers in Turkey with the local Kurds have been about this exact situation. They would like to see any and all Kurds who want to fight in northern Syria to be allowed entry into Syria. They're very upset about this. They're even accusing the Turkish government of supporting Islamic State, although there's no other evidence to support this, except they are not allowing any Kurdish fighters to enter this area in northern Syria.
Laura Wells in Istanbul, Turkey. Now, former British Prime Minister and current Middle East peace envoy Tony Blair believes airstrikes are not enough to defeat IS forces. During an essay, Mr. Blair warned that ground troops may be necessary to uproot the extremists. His message runs against the repeated line from President Obama that US troops will not return to Iraq and that an international effort is key to defeating the IS movement. LBC's Nick Ferrari spoke to Chris Hunter, a counter-terrorism consultant, and asked whether Tony Blair's anti-ISIS strategy was right.
Well, I think on a personal level, a lot of friends and colleagues have been saying for some weeks now, where is the Middle East peace envoy? He's, you know, remarkably quiet. But I think actually he is stating the obvious. I think there are points in his essay that are actually true. I think you can't interdict and defeat an organisation like IS with air power alone. That's pretty obvious. There are times and points at which you actually have to have somebody on the ground. But this whole phrase of boots on the ground, you know, that tends to imply large conventional forces. It doesn't necessarily need to be done with that. Of course, small units of special forces, specialist advisors, and of course the idea of using indigenous forces, you know, is obviously the preferred option. But I think, you know, he had to say something. I think he felt obliged to say something. And personally, I think he's just been stating the obvious, to be honest with you.
Would it not be, though, Mr. Hunter, a rather difficult, not that there are any easy wars, but a particularly difficult war or combat in that it would be guerrilla? You'd be taking on effectively guerrilla fighters.
That's right. And we're all, you know, very cognizant, and it's still very much, you know, in our memories from the Iraq campaigns and the Afghan campaigns. And fighting conventional warfare is very, very different to fighting an insurgency. You don't want to get bogged down, the famous or notorious phrase we heard before. And I think this idea that if you just do it by air power alone, that's not going to work. It's comparatively easy when terrorist and insurgent groups are in transit, in the open, you know, doing logistic moves from a safe haven to a safe haven. If you can identify them, then you can strike them at a time and place of your choosing and somewhere that's safe without any collateral damage. But unfortunately, these people don't play by the rules. They quite often hide in schools and hospitals and set their safe houses and their camps, you know, within public civil areas. And you can't just go sending in airstrikes then, because you are going to get collateral damage. You're going to fuel the insurgency by doing that, by killing civilians. And it's just going to, you know, enable them to grow in their numbers.
Which is, I would sense, and you'll know better than I do, but you're going to put lives on the line then, aren't you? You're putting men and possibly women in harm's way here then, lastly, Mr. Hunter.
Yeah, I think it's going to get to a stage. I mean, I think his point, you know, we have to be fair to Tony Blair over this one. His point that, you know, preferably using indigenous forces, the local population, you know, the local military, the local police, the local security forces is preferred. But I think, you know, when people talk about boots on the ground, we tend to think about conventional forces. But I think there definitely will be a need for, you know, small specialist forces, whether that's from the intelligence community, whether it's from the special forces community. And of course, you know, we need to bear in mind this is a collaborative international effort as well. It doesn't have to be British special forces. Indeed, it doesn't even necessarily have to be American special forces. You know, it should be the onus on the local nations, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, those sort of countries that, you know, are in the region that have a significant threat against them to actually put the manpower up and you know, take the lead on these missions.
LBC's Nick Ferrari with Chris Hunter, a counter-terrorism consultant and former high-ranking officer in the British military. This is FSN Reports. Reports that the leader of the extremist group Boko Haram, which has killed hundreds of people in northern Nigeria, may have been killed, have not been confirmed. That's despite both the Cameroon and Nigerian armies claiming they've killed Abubakar Shekau in the mountainous area between the two countries. Meanwhile, the release of more than 220 schoolgirls abducted from Chibok more than 5 months ago may be imminent. Gary Afonso reports from Abuja.
Reports of the death of Boko Haram's commander and the sect's leader, Abubakar Shekau, seem to be very unconfirmed at this stage and not official from either the Cameroonian or the Nigerian army. But what we can say is that the report stemmed from the claims by troops of both countries of being responsible for the death of the most wanted man in the northern or northeastern parts of Nigeria and also in parts of southern Chad and northern Cameroon. And troops of Cameroon on Sunday night claimed responsibility for killing Shekau with photos of the Boko Haram's leaders or his corpse as one of the proofs. But the Nigerian army has equally claimed that its troops killed the sect leader, and both reports were however not supported by the images very much showing the death of somebody that looks very similar to Shekau but not confirmed. And the conflict in the claim is possibly visible when troops from Cameroon said it killed Shekau in the Gambori Ngala border town. That's contrary to Nigerian army claims that Shekau was killed at Kondunga, which is a few kilometers away from Maiduguri, the Borno state capital in northeastern Nigeria. So very much unconfirmed at this stage, and it doesn't look like either the Nigerian army or the Cameroonian military have released official reports and won't do so very quickly. But for a short period of time, people in both Cameroon, Chad, and in Nigeria were very optimistic that an end might be in sight if this person was indeed killed, or at least a change in the attacks in this part of the country or in this part of the continent.
And Gary, also reports that the schoolgirls kidnapped from Chibok back in April this year may be released soon. Has the Nigerian government released any information surrounding this? And if so, do we know what the terms are?
Again, it seems that most of the confirmation has come from third parties, and it looks like Boko Haram has agreed to release the abducted 219 Chibok girls, and the federal government of Nigeria has simultaneously agreed to set free 18 key commanders that have been captured by Nigerian military forces over the past few months. And both parties have apparently asked their representatives to go back to their leaders and for the new swap deal to be put in place. And prior to these latest agreements of the talks, which were held in the capital city of Abuja and which was witnessed by officials of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Boko Haram had apparently insisted that a piecemeal release of the girls would not work, and among them 30 married Christian girls. And the federal government then offered a release of 18 sect leaders in detention. The two sides have now gone back to their principals, and the release of the girls could be very imminent, because at stake here is the fact that Boko Haram is insistent it can carry on with this war for another 50 to 100 years. And the federal government of Nigeria is saying that innocent victims of in rural areas and communities cannot be tolerated. And if this was a battle between military forces, it should remain as such. So hopefully the Chibok girls will be home soon.
attacks continue almost unabated in northeastern Nigeria. But what is the latest situation on the ground, and is the Nigerian military actually able to cope with this?
Yes, unfortunately, these attacks are continuing unabated. Fighters from this group have attacked the northeastern town of Minok over the weekend, and it sparked a gun battle that killed at least 36 people and continued well into the weekend. And they've also killed thousands over the past 5 years in struggles in this area between Chad, northern Cameroon, and northeastern Nigeria. Refugees streaming from villages through jungles into the hilly regions that make up the border of areas between places like Adamawa State and Borno State in the northeast of Nigeria, and Cameroon and southern Chad, where Lake Chad is all but a dry dust bowl these days. So these attacks coming across the border, where militants are not only attacking villages for what seems to be their religious campaign or their extremist religious campaign, but also for supplies and food. So attacking towns and taking over small towns, raising flags and saying that Boko Haram is now ruling in up to about 30 towns in small villages, very, very small places in rural northeastern Nigeria. And it is cause for concern, but obviously the major military offensive not started yet, and it looks like it could still be many months of these kinds of unabated attacks in this part of Nigeria.
Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. Now, a week after the Scottish referendum saw the nation vote to remain in the United Kingdom, debate has shifted to the fundamental constitutional changes being proposed, affecting both Scotland, England and the entire structure of the Union. Dr. Alan Rennick is an Associate Professor of Comparative Politics at the University of Reading, and he told LBC's Lisa Aziz what this historic moment meant.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say we need to go the way that most countries have gone and have a full written constitution. And that just raises so many controversies that it would get us mired in big debates about constitutional matters for years and years and years. And I don't see a need for that, to be perfectly honest. But I think we do need to be thinking very carefully about the whole structure of the Union, the roles of the various regions within England, as well as the roles of the four nations within the UK, and just how those are represented and so on.
And are there other countries, Dr. Rennick, where similar has happened? I mean, should we be looking more at the American model or places closer to home?
Well, the American model of the Constitutional Convention is certainly one that many people will be familiar with, but it's more than 200 years old now, and I don't think that's a model that we can really credibly follow. It was a time well before democracy when ordinary people weren't expected to have any say in politics. Now things are very, very different. I would say the best model to follow is actually a very recent one of a constitutional convention that took place in Ireland just a couple of years ago, 2013, that it did its work. And that was a convention. A third of its members were politicians chosen by the parties, but the remaining members, two-thirds of them, were ordinary citizens chosen at random from the electoral register, and they met at weekends. They heard lots of talks from experts and pressure groups and all these sorts of people on the various issues that they were debating. They deliberated, they discussed, they voted on proposals, and they produced all sorts of ideas that are now going through the Irish Parliament. There are going to be some referendums in Ireland next year. And I think that's actually the sort of model that we ought to be following.
Dr. Alan Rennick is an Associate Professor of Comparative Politics at the University of Reading, speaking to LBC's Lisa Aziz. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, some decidedly bitter news in the world of artificial sweeteners. Researchers at Israel's Weizmann Institute have found that consuming non-calorie sweeteners like saccharin instead of sugar may paradoxically promote obesity. The research is controversial because it comes as public health campaigners are exerting growing pressure on the food and drink industry to cut the sugar content in their products. Fiona Simon of the Financial Times spoke to Clive Cookson, the newspaper's science editor, about the study and its findings.
It was quite a complicated piece of research, this, at the Weizmann. It used both laboratory mice and human volunteers, and it involved three different artificial sweeteners that are widely used in consumer food and drinks: saccharin, sucralose, and aspartame. And essentially the researchers gave these sweeteners to the mice and the people and monitored their metabolism, both by examining their blood and looking at what was happening to their guts. And they found that these sweeteners, and particularly saccharin, had quite a big impact. It affected their blood glucose levels. It made both the mice and the humans more intolerant of glucose, which is a sign of impending diabetes and also a precursor of obesity. The studies didn't go on for long enough actually to show any clinical effects. These were what you might call biological markers of possible disease, and they were the sort of markers you do not want to get.
What's been the industry response to this research?
The industry, and I should add, several independent academics who've looked at the research, have pointed out that although there have been a few other studies pointing to possible health problems with artificial sweeteners, most studies have essentially shown that they're safe and have found no links to diabetes. Most of the previous concerns about artificial sweeteners have actually been about whether they increase your risk of cancer, and those risks have largely, though not entirely, subsided. I think the industry will be very worried about this, but if only because this study is published in Nature, which is one of the top two scientific journals in the world. It's a peer-reviewed study, and it's going to get a lot of exposure in the media just because of where it has been published, and possibly also because it's a pretty thorough study.
This isn't the first time, is it, that artificial sweeteners have been linked with diabetes? How worrying is that?
I think that if you consume these artificial sweeteners, you've got to expect some effect. Now, what's interesting about this study, which is new, is the way the researchers have linked it to something that's become rather fashionable in medical research circles, and that's the microbiota, microbiome. The microbiota is the vast number, billions and billions, of beneficial bacteria that live in our guts and which we need to metabolize, to digest things. And what this research is suggesting is that artificial sweeteners affect the balance of the bugs in our guts in a way that is not good for us. So that is a bit worrying.
Do you think we should all start to avoid artificial sweeteners?
One of the researchers, the lead author of this study, said that he was a great one for taking artificial sweeteners, popping saccharin and others, tiny tablets into his coffee. He personally has stopped. On the other hand, the researchers say their research needs more corroboration before we can make general population-level recommendations. Personally, and this is just Clive Cookson's personal advice, I would advise not taking artificial sweeteners and not taking sugar either. As one of the people commenting on this research said, unsweetened water, whether not sweetened artificially or naturally, must be the best thing to drink. So if you can avoid artificial sweeteners, do. But I suspect that if it's a choice of drinking too many sugary drinks and drinking too many artificially sweetened drinks, it's hard to say which is better or worse.
That's Clive Cookson, science editor of the Financial Times, in conversation there with the newspaper's Fiona Simon. You can read his ongoing coverage of all issues in the world of science daily in the newspaper and online at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show. Email us, reports@featurestory.com. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Nina Maria Potts with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.